The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, the conscience of psychiatry. You know, there are a lot of different consciences of psychiatry, and my guest today is one of them. My honor is to be one of so very few who are actually psychiatrists. Hard to have a conscience today and to be a psychiatrist. My guest and I have something in common in that we have crossed each other's paths directly and indirectly as reformers in the field of psychiatry for decades. And in the latest issue of the journal that I founded, Ethical Human Psychology and Psychiatry, we're both cited in an article which is very pertinent to her work and to many issues in psychiatry. The article is called Spider in a Jar, Women Who Have Recovered from Psychosis and Their Experience of the Mental Health System. It's by Brad Hagen and Gary Nixon, and they are, like my guest, from Canada. And what this article discovers from reviewing the literature and from other studies and from their own in-depth interviews with women who have recovered from psychosis is that psychiatry makes everything worse for them. And they recovered despite, not because of psychiatry. And they all spoke of the kinds of harm unto them. One kind of harm was what the article calls the label factory, the capricious, destructive nature of psychiatric labels. Another was, quote, invalidated and unheard, which seems to be the universal experience of being in a mental hospital, invalidated and unheard. The third was violence and violations. The mental hospital today and always really has been a place where dignity is left at the door and violations of personal privacy, personal rights of all kinds begin to occur once you've entered. And the final one they talk about in their picturesque language is smashing the jar, how the hopes and dreams of these women for change were held back and almost destroyed by the psychiatric system. My guest today, excuse me, is Bonnie Burstow, Dr. Bonnie Burstow, B-U-R-S-T-O-W. Bonnie is, like me, overeducated. She not only got an M.E.D., which is usually where people stop, in adult education and counseling, she went on to get a Ph.D. in educational theory, adult education, and a psychology minor at the University of Toronto. She's had a lot of scholarly honors and awards, and she's currently, since 2001, senior lecturer in the Department of Adult Education the school of the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education. She can tell you more about that. Today is an important moment in Bonnie's work this morning, and I'm eager to hear about it. She held their first event of an organization that she has helped found called Health Professionals Against Electroshock Speakers Bureau. I tell you, those of you listening, many of you are going to say, electroshock, and that didn't gone. No. I think it's as prevalent now as it was decades ago. It just sort of doesn't advertise itself as much in terms of the institutions and the doctors who are doing it. In fact, it's the victims of shock who like to advertise who the doctors are who did that oppressive, abusive, brain-damaging treatment to them. I hope the press conference went well. Dr. Bonnie Burstow, welcome to my show.
Thank you, Peter.
Well, tell us about the day or about anything else you'd like to begin with.
Well, the day went well. I spoke as a healthcare professional. Simon Adams spoke, who's a nurse educator, and Tara Defoe, who's also a psychotherapist, spoke. And, you know, when we speak, the press do not turn out in multitude. We had one press person there. But, you know, we spoke at the legislature, and so it gets piped into the room of all the press there, and we're waiting to see the results. But we announced very clearly something new on the landscape. Up until now, it's been individual healthcare professionals, people like you and people like me, speaking out against electroshock, and then survivors, and speaking out against electroshock, and then psychiatrists talking about how wonderful it is, and being the primary experts attended to. This is now saying that there is an organization of healthcare professionals who are experts and who are saying, this is a violation of the Hippocratic Oath. Being silent about it is a violation of the ethics of everybody who's involved in healthcare, and we will speak out against it just as professionals spoke out against lobotomies in the 70s. And so that's a milestone, and our hope is that similar organizations will get created by healthcare professionals in every major country in the world, and that will help us bring an end to what you and I both know is essentially a brain damaging treatment, and whose effectiveness is nothing more than brain damage.
I'm in total agreement with you about that. I've called electroshock simply closed head electrical injury. And it's also a closed head lobotomy. Instead of opening up the brain, the skull, and cutting, you pass sufficient electricity always through at least one of the frontal lobes to cause dysfunction and damage in the frontal lobes. We have animal studies showing it. We have human studies. Bonnie, go ahead.
Absolutely. And you have said that, I have said that, and also very significantly, neurologists whose area is precisely, you know, the brain, have said that. Sammons, Friedberg, and so on.
Well, the so on doesn't go on.
It doesn't go on very much further. No, it doesn't go on very much further, and that's our concern.
Bob Grimm has talked about it.
Absolutely, that's our concern. And you know, since we started to send out feelers for healthcare professionals for this organization, what we found is there are more people out there in the healthcare professions who agree with us than we thought, but they are scared to speak out against it. And that's what we're hoping, you know, as we speak out more, to do something about. And our invitation to healthcare professionals is, we understand you're scared, but we need you to do something about this treatment and join us. And if you are fired from your job, and that's certainly what some people have told us, they're worried about being fired, we will stand up with you on that. And, you know, Peter, you know, and we both know that people will come after you for speaking up.
Yes, Bonnie. First of all, I think what you're doing is incredibly important. It could be a new breath of life against this death treatment. And anything I can do to help you, just to having you on this show and giving you an opportunity to speak for an hour with me and archive this is just the beginning. Anything I can do within my power and my limits, I'm going to be glad to do. I can't imagine anything more important right now.
And we are delighted to have you as one of our international consultants. Absolutely delighted.
Great. You're certainly right about the violence. that these, well, what you said is, you know, people get fired, they run into trouble if they stand up against the lobotomists and the electroshockers, in this case, the electrical lobotomists. That's what we should call these guys, the electrical lobotomists, the shock doctors. It's my understanding psychologically and politically that anyone who spends a lot of time perpetrating electroshock has the mentality of an abuser. And abusers, when they are outed or threatened to be outed, become very violent. They'll become more violent toward the people they're abusing. They'll become more violent toward the people who are accusing them. It's very much like trying to out a husband who's abusing his wife and children in a small town. So it becomes very frightening to other people. When I published Electroshock, Its Brain Disabling Effects, the only medical book, John Friedberg did a popular book, the only medical book that's ever really taken on shock, just a whole book, back in 1979, there were threats against Ursula Springer, the owner of Springer Publishing Company. She was threatened with a boycott and practically spat upon at the American Psychiatric Association meetings. And she had to have a lot of courage to put that book out. This is a very violent group of people, the people who support shock treatment.
You know, this is not an isolated thing in history. In history, there have often been institutions that have done horrid things, and you fight against them, and they will retaliate. But you fight against them, and there's enough of you speaking truth, you eventually win.
I think we will win this eventually.
I think you and I have been at this around electroshock for so many decades, right?
Yes. I've been very frustrated by my own personal inability and working with others to do much about shock treatment.
Psychiatry has gotten more powerful since the days in the 70s when we got rid of lobotomy. And you know, we have seen the growth of a more and more powerful institution that's mushroomed all over the world, and that is legitimated by laws, and that can rule through texts. And that's a very tough opponent to be taking on, and yet that's precisely the job that we have to do.
I think one of the things that impedes our success is that it is so hard for people to believe that physicians would purposely and consciously damage the brain, hide its effects, and call it treatment. The good thing about lobotomy was that no one could deny it was damaging the brain. Even when they tried to argue, oh, no, we're just correcting biochemical imbalances, it was patently ridiculous. You're burning the brain, slicing the brain, poisoning the brain, melting holes in the brain. But shock treatment does that. It gives widespread damage to the brain. We have animal studies showing widespread hemorrhages throughout the brain. We have we know the dynamics of the heat injury, of the seizure injury, of the breakdown of the blood-brain barrier. We know that after the convulsion, the individual literally has all the signs of head injury, and that the head injury grows with each treatment. But it's hard for people to face this.
And it's not as obvious to them. And in the face of mainstream psychiatry saying it's safe and effective, and in the face of something that a violence that is cosmeticized, so it's not obvious to people, whereas it's pretty hard to cosmeticize lobotomy, you know.
Yeah.
It's very, very difficult for people to take it in, which is why we have a major educational job facing us.
Now, it's very interesting what's happened now after trying for a few decades. Those of us who have opposed shock have finally convinced the FDA to classify it as a dangerous, potentially dangerous procedure that actually needs to be examined by the FDA.
That's great, because we haven't had that success in Canada.
And this is after decades and decades. They're going to admit that causing multiple seizures, knocking people out and giving them concussion-like symptoms, including long-term follow-up studies where most folks still have head injury, that maybe they'll examine it. And you know, as you know, Bonnie, it was a tie vote. It was a tiebreaker on the FDA committee. The chair had to do the tiebreaker to have the FDA examine ECT. What a bizarre world.
Yeah, we're living in a very bizarre world where one branch of medicine does everything possible to prevent grand mal seizures because they know it damages the brain, and another branch creates grand mal seizures saying it doesn't damage the brain.
People need to know that the whole history of psychiatry has been that of damaging the brain. Actually, initially the body. Initially the body. And then in the 30s, what I call the real revolution in psychiatry, they gave up this very difficult process of trying to beat senses into people or bleed them or poison the body and give them diarrhea and vomiting as attempts to control people. And they turned to damaging the brain directly with shock treatment, insulin coma, which kills brain cells, and then lobotomy. So the real revolution in psychiatry is not the drugs. It's realizing that attacking the brain is the way to subdue mental patients. But now what we're witnessing is we do this to everybody, not just to people in the hospitals.
Absolutely. And it's a shift to almost a bureaucracy, right?
Oh, that's interesting. Never heard that term.
Where there's
that's good.
A rule by medicine in the name of the state.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The FDA does more as an agency of the state to approve the use of biological techniques. You know, the FDA never took a stand on lobotomy. I mean,
yeah.
It's just a bizarre situation. The bizarre situation that we're in with the government doing more to promote the things that it's supposed to monitor than to actually monitor them.
Tell me some more
about your ideas about organizing against shock treatment, especially professionals, which I'm glad to see, because, of course, the victims, the patients have been organizing for a long time.
Absolutely, and that's terribly important. But what we haven't had, I mean, you and I and, and Salmond and people like that, we're an anomaly. We're not the majority of healthcare professionals. We need healthcare fields to rise up against this just as they rose up against lobotomies.
Well, you know, I have a little different view of what happened with lobotomy.
I know.
I don't think the health professionals rose up. I took 5 years out of my life, literally, Bonnie, to organize an international campaign to stop lobotomy from coming back. It was different in those days. I had two congressmen and a senator on my board. I was able to go to Congress and get legislation passed calling for a psychosurgery commission. I wrote legislation to stop federal funding, although that didn't pass. The funding did stop. Now I was involved in bringing a malpractice suit against Harvard neurosurgeons. You know, I just spent literally, I was poor by the end of the 5 years. But the coalition had no well-known physicians.
No well-known physicians, right.
No, the coalition was a feminist. The feminist movement was very strong at the time. African Americans, the Black Caucus had gave me a lot of support because I found that the brains of little children, black children, as young as age 5, were being mutilated at the University of Mississippi. There was this big coalition I built, and out of that came my old center, the Center for the Study of Psychiatry.
Right.
Got a new center now. But we never had, I never got the support that I expected. I was attacked by the American Psychiatric Association. I was attacked by the AMA, although they also published a very important letter I wrote about all this. So we've never been able to get professionals really to go after these horrendous treatments.
No, we've to agree gotten it, but nowhere near what would be helpful. I agree, and this is an attempt to shift that around.
You know, one of the things that's done is the residents, the young psychiatrists in training, are forced to give shock treatment.
I know.
One of the reasons why I left Harvard, my first year of residency, I finished it, and then I chose to leave because they insisted on my doing shock treatment. And then, so then I went back to where I'd had my internship at the State University of New York Upstate Medical Center, where Tom Zoss was a professor. And they again said, you don't do it, we're going to fire you, and that'll be the end of your career. And I had one courageous classmate who refused to participate, and they fired him. He went to Canada. He's passed on since, but he went to Canada and became a general practitioner because his career in psychiatry had been ruined because he refused to give shock treatment. That's how desperate these people are to prevent any criticism. They won't let any young people get through if they can help it without their getting blood on their hands and joining the club.
The other group, and this is my current push, but it has been my push for years, that it would be helpful if it got taken up more actively, is the feminist movement. I mean, we all know that women are electroshocked 2 to 3 times as often as men. We all know that control of wives, etc., has been huge in electroshock, and we all know that women are damaged more than men by the very same treatment. So this, you know, this could also give life to the movement if we had more feminist backing of it.
Now, I'm not familiar with the concept that women are more susceptible to brain damage. Makes some sense.
Absolutely.
Skulls are thinner.
Absolutely. You know, let me tell you that before Sackheim study, and Sackheim definitely proved that women are more brain damaged by men by electroshock, but before the Sackheim study, in 1984, a number of us were responsible for doing public hearings into electroshock in Toronto. And you could tell it even before we had the empirical research. We had men who've been electroshocked who gave testimony and women who electroshock who gave testimony, and we could hear the greater damage. Typically with women, we found out that 8 years of their lives or 4 years of their lives or 10 years of their lives were wiped out. We almost never heard that with men. Typically, we heard that they can't do arithmetic anymore, they can only do minor tasks, etc. You could hear it loud and clear, that gender difference, and it wasn't until the Sackheim study that we actually got something that proved it on a scientific level. But those of us who listened to those 30, 40 people testify, we had no doubt about that difference.
This is very, very interesting. I mean, one of the things that one could look at, I suspect that the shock doctors give women more intensive energy doses and give them longer treatments and more commonly give them, quote, maintenance shock, where you literally keep the person demented by giving them one shock treatment a week for months and years at a time. So it may be that the practice is rougher on women, and it may also be perhaps the skull doesn't provide as much protection.
Yeah, I don't know, but the Sackheim study came out with greater brain damage for women for every type of electroshock, and this was a controlled experiment. Horrible that we have such controlled experiments, but as long as we have them, let's take a look at what they show. So the same amount of shock, women were more damaged, which might say that women have a lower ECT threshold, a lower threshold for seizure. It might say many things, but, it is very clear that women are being more damaged.
Yeah. Not aware of that. Thank you for that information. Tell me more just about what you're planning to do. I mean, I could talk endlessly about the damaging effects. In fact, maybe in the future I'll just do a show by myself where I, document for folks that want to have an hour of it all the harmful effects of ECT and how it works.
Well, our current aim is to try to get more professionals joining us, try to get invitations from professional groups to come and present an electroshock, and to try to shift the stage of what things are like from the media, so that when a shock story comes out, they think they have to interview one of us. Now, that would shift the dynamic, because right now, what they think they have to do is to get one survivor who said shock was the greatest thing since sliced bread, one that says it harms them, and a psychiatrist who says it's safe and effective. We're trying to shift that balance. And so we're going to speak on at every opportunity we can, and try to shift the dynamics so they actually think they have to include us. And I think if they do, we can start creating a much greater presence for a professional critique of electroshock. Because you and I both know that the average human being out there is not going to go and read the studies.
Well, the average psychiatrist isn't going to go and read the study.
Aren't.
How many psychiatrists
have
read the SACOM study?
When I was on a radio show with the lead psychiatrist for the Canadian Psychiatric Association position paper on electroshock that just, that recently came out, it was clear that he was unfamiliar with the literature, even though he wrote what was seemingly a definitive piece on it. He was unaware, for instance, of the SACOM study, which was the biggest study in shock history. Pretty hard to be unaware of it unless you're either enormously incompetent or not telling the truth.
It's very hard to confront this pattern of lying. I know that I went through, during some of the controversy around shock treatment, I went through multiple studies and I reviewed them. But by the way, let me tell folks where they can get my most up-to-date writing on this. My 2008 book, Brain Disabling Treatment, the second edition, has a very detailed chapter. And then I wrote a piece for the FDA during its recent deliberation, and that you can find on my website if you search for shock treatment or go to the scientific papers shock treatment. So I've got a lot of the science there for you. But what shocked me the most was going, well, I don't know if it shocked me the most, but one of the things that dismayed me the most was going and reviewing, for example, the American Psychiatric Association's brief to the FDA, where they have three studies that they claim show that the electroshock reduces the suicide rate. And two of the studies have nothing to do with it at all. And the third study shows that, if anything, it increases the suicide rate. So this ability to lie coming out of the mouths of committees from the American Psychiatric Association, for example, to present absolutely false material that's the opposite of what they're saying is very dismaying.
It is dismaying, and it's dismaying to see them do this in print. It's dismaying to see them do this in, broadcast. It's dismaying to see them do this as they teach their students these things. It's also dismaying, one of my most telling memories was being called into a review committee where the psychiatrist was trying to give shock to this woman who was locked up in a psychiatric institution and give her shock against her will, and it went to a review committee to either authorize it being given against her will or not authorize, and I was called in to try to help her, essentially, by her lawyer. And while we were there, and we'd never seen anything, we'd not been given any documents, the psychiatrist said that she hadn't carried down a job for 2 years. We had discovered she had. The psychiatrist said all sorts of things and then went on to say it wouldn't affect her, it would not cause memory loss, it would not cause. And finally we called for a break saying, we need to see the files. And as we saw the files, we saw that she had carried down a job. We saw that. But we, as we were going through this, the psychiatrist called the lawyer aside and said, she's not eating very much, and that's the problem we have here. Let me give her shock, and then she won't remember why she's not eating, and so she'll eat. Which means he knew it would create memory loss. He was counting on it, and he was lying right there to the review committee.
It's amazing. It's amazing. I'm talking to my friend from a long, long time back now, Bonnie Burstow, Dr. Burstow, who is a courageous reformer and has been all along, I'm sure, for her entire career. We're going to take a break now, and when we come back, maybe we can talk some about what the human toll is, what really happens to folks that get shock treatment, what they tell us and show us about their awful experience. As we go to break, and we'll be back shortly. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin, returning with my guest, Bonnie Burstow. Before bringing Bonnie in, two thoughts I wanted to share with you. One, confirming what we've been discussing about just how corrupt psychiatry is in regard to this. Last week, I gave what I think is one of the most important hours I've ever presented on the air. I talked about the history of psychiatry in Nazi Germany and how the Holocaust would not have occurred, very probably would not have occurred, if psychiatry hadn't built the whole principle in the form of the mass murder of mental patients, hadn't developed killing centers, the whole fake soap, the crematoriums, the whole business, and then actually trained the SS to do the same thing. And even the, you know, the first head of an extermination camp was the former head of a euthanasia center. So there's this direct continuity between psychiatry and the Holocaust, and in a causal way. I'm giving you a brief thumbnail of stuff I've written about, and I hope folks will listen to that show. Well, Robert Lifton wrote a book about the what he called the Nazi doctors. Already misleading, because they weren't Nazi doctors. They were all the psychiatrists in every one of them in Germany. No one protested. Nearly all of them were members of the party, and they did it before they were Nazis, before they were Nazis. They were planning the extermination of mental patients. But what Lifton comes up and says is that there was one good thing they did do in the Nazi
electroshock.
Yes.
They experimented with electroshock treatment. Yeah.
You want to know how evil and backward psychiatry is? That's what a famous progressive psychiatrist could come up with. I mean, just appalling. You're aware of that? You're just on top of all this stuff.
Yeah, no, I've read the book, and I thought, okay, I have to let Lifton off the hook. He just doesn't understand. But he unraveled some other important stuff. But clearly, the fact that he thought this was one great thing they did, he didn't see. You know, and nor did he put together that electroshock was created in fascist Italy and what that meant, and that this was part of a tradition.
Yeah. The other thing I thought, as we get started for the second portion here, is folks really do need a description of electroshock. So let me just briefly say that electroshock began by plugging two electrodes into wall current, putting one electrode on each side of the front of the brain on the temples of a person, giving them sufficiently damaging shock to the head to cause a convulsion, after which the patient was numb, docile, passive, and pronounced to be improved. We now have much more elaborate shock treatment. In particular, patients are anesthetized first and given paralytic drugs so that they have to be breathed artificially with a bag breather. Now, the purpose of that is not to prevent brain damage. Psychiatry has never striven to prevent brain damage or wouldn't do lobotomy and shock. The only purpose was to prevent all the lawsuits over breaking people's spines. And the new shock treatment, supposedly, I gave at Harvard in 62. So that's how new the new modified variations are. They're not new at all. And everything we're talking about, the damaging effects of shock treatment, have to do with the newest forms of shock treatment.
Absolutely.
The Sackheim study.
Absolutely. My father had a modified shock in 1960 or 61. Yeah,
that's God.
That's how far back it goes.
Yeah, that's when I was giving it in 62 at Harvard. Where did that happen to him?
In Winnipeg, Manitoba. It's one of
Should
the problems.
Should we talk a little about just how this affects people in a little more detail? Why don't you talk a little about that?
Well, the effects are, one could give a huge laundry list. There's confusion. There's there's huge, often very huge memory loss, and it affects both memory before shock and ability to remember things after shock. So it's, you know, there's also trauma. And the trauma both comes from the fact that this happened to you and from having to walk through life with a brain that you can't rely on. One of the effects that you occasionally hear people talk about that I think is very, very important is also diminished affect, like you get from lobotomy. But beyond that, an enormous diminished sense of life. You know, that life no longer has its vibrancy. I'm writing a novel right now where the central character has an electroshock, and toward the end of the novel there is a hearing into electroshock, and one of the people testifying at the hearing says, you know, I could give you a whole laundry list of symptoms of what was caused by the shock, but for the sake of expediency, I'll settle for just one. I was alive before. I'm not alive now. Now, I think that's a very significant, and we all know that, and we've all seen it with people who've been given shock.
Absolutely. It causes diffuse brain injury and hence widespread disseminated injury to the mental processes, affecting all of the mental processes. And one of the first things that people notice is the apathy or indifference, the loss of zest and involvement and love and passion that comes with that kind of injury. And it's very, very variable from person to person. And you do see people who feel they've fully recovered. But in my experience, and the Sackheim would confirm study, that recovery is rarely complete after this.
There's also, you know, and this stems from it, but there's also that whole existential thing. What we are human beings, is our memory. You know, we are, our identity comes from our memory, and our ability to project ourselves into the future depends on our being able to project ourselves back into the past and make effective selection of what worked for us in the past, what was meaningful in the past. If we can't do that, there's a profound interference of what it means to be a human being.
Yeah. Let's take a call. We have a caller who had a question about concussion. I hope it relates somewhat to our conversation today, but of course, shock treatment causes a concussive disorder. Doug, are you there?
I'm here.
Is that my friend, Doug?
Yes, it is.
Hi. How are you today?
I'm doing fine. I was listening to your program and wanted to share something that I observed and see if you all...
Well, introduce yourself to the audience and to Bonnie.
The question issue basically is related to the symptoms following the electric shock treatment. And,
okay.
Here is a list of symptoms, which you've already shared, actually. Obviously, loss of consciousness. Part of that is the anesthesia that they give in doing this. But the headaches, poor concentration, amnesia, sleepiness, loss of coordination, slurred speech or incoherent speech, irritability, anxiety, depression, ringing in the ears, vacant stare, which I think those words weren't used, but certainly the loss of sense of one's being alive would fit that. Disorientation, nausea and vomiting, and effects on pupils. Are those reasonable symptoms for somebody might experience after ECT?
I would say that they were likely symptoms. I would add a horrible, horrible headache that we've heard from almost everyone. I would add one other that I haven't mentioned yet and that I've heard certainly from woman after woman. Terror.
Terror. Oh, that's
good. All, you know, here's, you know, women are given electroshock, as an answer for postpartum depression that disappears by itself. And the kind of thing we've heard from women is, oh, my God, all I did was have a baby. And look what they did to me. Yeah. Now, if I really do something, what will they do to me now? So I have to be very, very careful. That's terror.
Right.
Now, the gentleman who's called is my friend Doug Bauer from Georgia. He's a minister and a psychologist. He's a wonderful man. And I want to introduce you to Bonnie, formerly to Bonnie Burstow, two really wonderful people.
Nice to meet you, Doug.
Good to meet you. I've enjoyed listening to your program. Let me share quickly what I just read to you. I've been working on a certificate in sports management injuries, and I just read you the list of the concussion symptoms, which I know, Peter, you profoundly argued that essentially with the brain damage, you're creating concussion when you do this treatment. And I think that this really kind of bears that out. And this text isn't related to ECT at all. It's about what I'm reading from was concussion.
And yeah, these acute symptoms you're describing, I mean, there's a horrible headache, nausea, vomiting is possible during the acute phase afterward. Then you're left with the post-concussive syndrome. The thing about the brain is that all the wonderful stuff that makes us unique depends on our healthy brain. So the healthy brain's capable of things we never imagined. I mean, who knows what's going to be brought forth in the world tomorrow and in a century. But the injured brain is limited and responds basically the same way. So if you're given an electric shock or you're hit in the head with a baseball bat, or you're massively overdosed with psychiatric drugs, the acute phenomena has a tendency to look the same because the injured brain has only just a few things in the way it will respond. And then when you injure the brain long term, whether you're poisoning it, giving a shock treatment, electroshock, lobotomy, all these things long term, including getting your head battered playing sports or boxing, it begins to look the same, this long-term concussive kind of phenomenon. I'm actually just going to be publishing a paper soon. There'll be a chapter in one of my books about this, because the effects I'm seeing in long-term patients on drugs is no different from the long-term effects of all the injuries that you can impose on the brain. Now, we have another guest who's a caller who's raised an issue of Hitler being on drugs, and I'm going to invite this person on if they can give some documentation that Hitler was on some sort of psychoactive substance. I doubt it very much, at least early in his life. Nicole, are you there?
Yeah, hi. How you doing, Doctor?
Hi. Have you got some evidence that Hitler was on psychoactive substances?
I have no evidence at all, and that was, you know, that's part
all
of my...
All right. Next caller. We'll go back to Bonnie. It's hard
That was my question. I didn't know if
he wasn't. So thanks for calling in.
Psychoactive drugs was largely a slightly later phenomenon.
I think so. I think that's right. I think Hitler was an insane madman all on his own. Some people have raised questions of his being gassed and things like that, but Hitler had a very sharp mind. He could write, he could speak, he could organize. He wasn't brain damaged as far as I know.
No evidence from anything I've seen, and he certainly did not write like a brain damaged man. A very strange man, yes, but not brain damaged.
Yeah, and both of us, both Bonnie Burstow and I think, have read some of the biographies of Hitler and certainly read some of his writings. You know, we are creating in psychiatry an epidemic of chronic brain impairment. I'm going to be talking more and more about this in the next year. But that's literally what we're doing. We're creating people by the millions, starting with our children, who walk around with chronic brain impairment.
We definitely are, and chronic pain impairment, and you know, we see movements to give psychiatry more and more what is called rights, which means there's going to be more and more impairment. Right now in Ontario, there's a blueprint for what mental health should be looking like, you know, in the future, coming from a Liberal provincial government, of all things, which is asking for a change in the mental health law so that people don't have to be dangerous to themselves and others to be locked up. They only have to look like, you know, to a psychiatrist that they might improve if they were locked up and subjected to treatment. Now, can you imagine?
Oh, God.
I mean, that is a frightening, frightening phenomenon.
Frightening thing.
And, you know, and once again, it's conflating, and we certainly saw this in the Nazi period, it's conflating human rights with the power of the state, right?
Yes.
Because it's all for the right to be healthy, which is not unlike the right to have a mercy death, which meant to be killed. I mean, all of these are conflations, and that's very serious when we start talking about the right to treat, the right to do all these things, and think of them as human rights, because human rights are the right to have institutions not do things to you.
Yes. I think we're going to be viewing psychiatry, and especially in regard to children in future centuries, as the abuse of our time, the domestic kind of abuse of our time. And it's just so good that you're doing this this work in Canada. I'm, by the way, Bonnie, I'm involved in a couple of lawsuits. You know, I've been approved as an expert in Canada, and
yeah,
I've been involved in the first successful tardive dyskinesia suit, first actual tardive dyskinesia suit ever in Canada, and the first successful one a number of years ago. And I'm involved in a couple of suits now, and maybe at some point I can, you know, I can get permission to tell you a little about them. But I'm really hoping that Canada might spearhead some of the changes that we need, that we're not going to get in the U.S. with this enormous power structure here that psychiatry has.
One of the things we're doing with this new organization, and this is an interesting and it is a different way to put yourself forward, is that we are very well aware, besides being an enormously powerful institution, psychiatry is a patriarchal institution. And which is one of the reasons that one of the things we've done is make sure that we have a high percentage of nurses as speakers. Because what we're trying to do is draw on the public's understanding that nurses are into an epistemology of caring as opposed to, you know, psychiatry, which is into an epistemology of control. And we think ultimately the public understands that difference and are going to trust the feminine over the masculine.
Yeah, my understanding is that nurses rate higher than physicians now in public polls.
Way higher. When they did a survey of which professions they trust, people trust the most, doctors in general rated low. Nurses were the top respected profession, the person they would trust. You would tell them the truth. So we're wanting to tap into that, right?
Well, I think that's absolutely wonderful what you're doing. I'm trying. Yeah, go ahead. Tell us some more about your work.
My work?
Yes, in general.
You know,
let people know about this wonderful Dr. Bonnie Burstow.
I've been doing this for a long time. I've been doing this for a long time, and I teach at a graduate school called Ontario Institute for Studies and Education, and this is very interesting because many people come and take my courses beginning with the medical model. And vast majority of time, by the end of the classes, they have come to critique the medical model. That includes nurses, that includes all sorts of people, that includes psychologists, etc. And so a lot of my work has been on the educational front. I've been working on other fronts as well. I've organized as an activist. You know, I've spoken out at public hearings. I don't know if I ever told you how I got started speaking out, and it wasn't originally against electroshock. I was, have you ever heard of the Aldo Alviani case, Peter?
No, I don't recall it.
1980, a man was ended up dead in one of our psychiatric institutions, not an uncommon thing. And what happened is, well, people knew I was critical. You know, I wasn't active. I was just very critical. A nurse got in touch with me from the hospital and said, Bonnie, we've killed another person. And I said, and I've got the files to prove it. And I said, get me the files. If you got the files, I'd like a copy. And what had happened was that they had given somebody about five times the dosage of safe medication, and that's medicine's concept of safe, not my concept of safe, and essentially killed him, right? And then he was shipped to a hospital, a general hospital, where he was declared dead on arrival, you know, as a kind of, as far as I could see, a cover-up. And I got the files to the opposition and the health critic, and they raised it in Parliament, and it became a major issue. And a newly formed organization called On Our Own, which is of psych survivors, tried to get standing at the hearing, and so it created a whole
Judy Chamberlain. Huh? Judy Chamberlain. Judy Chamberlain's group.
No. On Our Own was a Ontario group, a Toronto group, okay. Named same name as Judy Chamberlain's.
Okay.
Right. So after that, about a year later, I did a few other things that were, you know, getting things from the files into the health critic's hands, and then I thought, you know, I can't continue doing it that way, and then I got very involved with psych survivor movements, and I got very involved as a professional, starting to write and starting to speak out. So it's been since 1980, right? Long time. And I particularly enjoy, you know, teaching in a graduate school because it gives me the opportunity to help people get past the hegemony of psychiatry. Because it really is hegemonic. People really think that there are discrete things known as mental illnesses out there, etc. And it gives a chance to actually look beyond that, to look at what we are actually talking about when we're talking about the crises and the misery that human beings encounter in their life.
It's important for us to, I think, say a little bit more about this medical model. People think, you know, who are sophisticated today enough to read magazines and newspapers, that this is a new thing, this claim that mental disorders are physical and biochemical, and we have all this new evidence. In fact, it's not new at all. The entire origin of the profession is in the state mental hospital system, when psychiatrists, when physicians were put in charge of these giant lockups, which were mostly for the poor back during the early days of the Industrial Revolution. So from the beginning, these lockups were justified, the civil locking up rather than criminal locking up, but people were justified on the grounds that they were ill in some way or another. The group that was the poorhouses just disappeared, and they became the state mental hospitals. And so throughout the history of psychiatry, which grows out of the state mental hospital system, psychiatry has always claimed that the people they treat have medical illnesses. And it doesn't matter who they're treating, whether it's just the poor or whether it's elderly people being locked up who have no place to go, or whether it's people who are having first episodes of profound emotional and spiritual disturbance. It all gets labeled physical, not proven physical, but labeled physical. The founder of American psychiatry did experiments back in the revolutionary days on brains and found that mentally ill people had inflamed brains. So this has gone on and on. And in fact, speaking of Nazi Germany, if you go back to the 30s, there were even more studies being put out then proving that mental illness was genetic than we have now.
Absolutely.
And all of those studies failed and sort of things dried up. So it's not new at all. It's always been physicians, psychiatrists or physicians, claiming that what they're treating is biological and genetic without any evidence, and then, oddly enough, turning to damaging the brain, toxic drugs, electroshock, lobotomy, while claiming the brain needs to be taken care of. It doesn't make any logical sense. It's got to be viewed as some sort of oppressive, passionate, misguided view of humanity.
And the enormous power wishes of a particular profession, right?
Yes, yes. Bonnie, we have only a minute or two. Tell folks how they can get in touch with you.
Yeah, the difficulty psychiatry faces is that if this isn't medical, there's no reason to bring in doctors to cure it. Right?
Yeah, exactly. That's right. You want your doctor to give you a good physical and then send you to somebody who knows something about
mental upset. That's right.
Bonnie, give some identifying information for yourself where people can get on hold of you.
They can email me at bonnie.burstow@utoronto.ca. That's University of Toronto.
Do it again slow.
Bonnie, Bonnie.burstow, at utoronto.ca.
Bonnie, thank you very, very much for being on the show. Let me conclude with a couple of thoughts. You know, we have a choice as to how we're going to treat human beings. We're either going to treat our fellow human beings as fundamentally spiritual in quality, as fundamentally to be treasured and honored, and when they're injured, to be nurtured and taken care of. We can view them as folks to be that we have empathy for, with whom we identify, and who, when they're in trouble, we can say, "There, but for the grace of God, go I." That's the good way to view human beings. It will limit the damage we do and maximize the good that we do. In psychiatry, people are treated not as beings or agents or souls. They're treated as objects, as disease entities, to be controlled, managed, handled, and if necessary, chopped up, lobotomy, shocked with electricity, or given toxic agents. And involuntarily so. We're looking at two drastically different views of life. I don't think there's any way of escaping that reality. Thank you, Bonnie Burstow.
Thank you very much, Peter. Let's continue our work.
Yes, together.
Absolutely.
Been listening to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bregan and his lifelong reform work on www.bregan.com. That's BREGGIN.com. To the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bregan and his lifelong reform work on www.bregan.com. That's BREGGIN.com.